From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello and welcome to another episode of ARRL, The Doctor Is In. I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, we're going to talk about loops, but we're going to talk about tiny loops. Tiny loops, only 2-3 feet in diameter, otherwise known as magnetic loops. However, you have to begin by telling me, are they truly magnetic in the sense of an MRI machine in your living room, or, you know, that pulls the hip joint out of your leg, or what are we talking about here?
Well, they have a very strong localized magnetic field associated with them, and the smaller they are and the more power they have in them, the more magnetic field you have, and it can be dangerous. It will not pull your hip apart, I don't think, but
how dangerous are we talking about
here? Well, you know, I don't have the numbers in front of me. In fact, Kai Siowak wrote a addendum, which was in Tech Correspondence not too long ago,
I believe,
discussing that. And he had put together some of the original work on RF safety that was built into the ARL publications on that and realized he hadn't really covered that in sufficient detail. And I suggest looking that up if somebody's going to be seriously using a small loop in an area where there are people. The magnetic field is a local phenomenon that drops off rapidly. And it's important to note that the fields, no matter what happens locally around the antenna, the electromagnetic radiation that leaves the antenna and goes off into space looks the same and smells the same as radiation from any antenna.
So there's nothing magical about it.
There's nothing magical about it at distance, but within the confines of the loop and right around it, there are some local effects that do need to be taken into account. So it does have a strong magnetic field, and it's all concentrated in that one place, which is kind of the big difference. So it needs to be taken into account. So if you have a loop on your back, you probably don't want to run high power.
Well, no, or near my head.
Yes,
for
exactly.
Example,
well, that might be okay, but not.
Are these the miracle antennas everybody says they are, really?
Well, they're miracle in the sense that they can do a far better job on HF than anything else their size, I think.
For their size.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, you can make other antennas, types of antennas such as dipoles and so forth, small by loading them an incredible amount, but the efficiency of those goes down very rapidly. And there are efficiency problems associated with loops, small loops also. And we should make a point here that small loops are very different from large loops. It's not the same kind of thing as small dipoles and large dipoles, because those are essentially the same except for their size.
Mm-hmm.
But big loops, such as the loop element in a cubicle quad antenna, for example, which is a full wavelength circumference loop,
yes,
is definitely a large loop. And the radiation from that is perpendicular to the plane of the loop. So that's why you see an antenna such as a quad that rotates, and you point the broadside of the antenna towards the intended destination. So the radiation is primarily perpendicular to the axis of the loop.
Mm-hmm.
The small loop, it's a whole different thing. And with a large loop, the current distribution around it is much like two dipoles, one above each other, if fed from the bottom.
Yes.
Well, the small loop, the circumference is so small, and what we mean by a small loop is one whose circumference is less than half a wavelength, but mostly we see them at, say, a tenth of a wavelength or so in circumference. So it's usually multiple turns, and such that the current all the way around the loop is in the same phase kind of thing. It doesn't act like a dipole or like a pair of dipoles like the big loop does. And in fact, the radiation, instead of being perpendicular to the plane of the loop, is in the plane of the loop. A lot of people have a little adjustment to go through to get used to that.
Yes.
That's the way it works. I remember discovering that in graduate school. So it's not, you know, something that's immediately obvious to the casual ham.
Not at all, no.
And in fact, if you pick up a portable broadcast radio, the type transistor AM radio, its antenna is almost always a ferrite rod with multiple turns, and that's a very small loop. The circumference is typically less than half an inch.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, the diameter is less than half.
The diameter, yes.
So
yes.
The circumference is three times that.
Right.
But an inch and a half. So that's a very small loop. And it's multiple turns. And we think of the radiation being broadside to the antenna rod, which it is. But if you think about where the loop is, the actual loop is going the other way. The loop is in the direction that the turns of the loop are in the direction that it receives from.
Mm-hmm.
So it is just like the small loop without a rod in the middle. It receives in the plane of the loop.
Yes.
So they can work very well. There are some limitations that it's important to keep in mind when designing and building small loops. Largely, the impedance of the loop is very low, which means that the connections for the feed to the loop can have significant loss if there's any resistance in the connections. And it's very hard to make connections without some resistance in them.
Yes.
Particularly mechanical connections. Similarly, the loop itself, the wire of the loop, has resistance, and that can result in significant loss. So you'll see some loops made out of copper tubing, for example, which has much less resistance than copper wire.
Is that copper tubing without any joints whatsoever, or is it continuous piece?
I think copper tubing with good pipe fittings and good wet or soldered joints is almost as good as solid copper. But any kind of mechanical joints with compression fittings or one kind of thing or another is asking for trouble. It may work fine the first month or week or 6 months, but eventually there'll be corrosion and so forth, and then it's really terrible, and it happens slowly so you don't notice it. Similarly, the other thing about small loops is they have very narrow bandwidth. This is characteristic of most small antennas of all sorts. And the bandwidth can be so small that you need to really have some kind of tuning mechanism to tune as you go. As you tune your receiver, you've got to tune the loop along with it, because the bandwidth can be, for a small loop, can be 10 kilohertz or less.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're talking in terms of a 2-to-1 SWR bandwidth, what kind of bandwidth are we usually talking about, really?
Well, if we're talking about something on 80 meters or so, typical dipole would have a 2-to-1 SWR of 150, bandwidth of 150 kilohertz. The loop might have a 2-to-1 SWR of 10 kilohertz. So that's quite a difference. And you don't have to tune your transceiver very far to be out of range.
Oh, no.
In fact, if you're operating on a single frequency, that's pretty easy. You make it work on that frequency and hope nothing changes and nobody builds a nest in it or something. And you'll probably be okay. By the way, if they build a nest in it, they'll be gone the first time you transmit, probably, one way or the other. Gone or fried. But in many cases, the tuning has to happen where the antenna is, so you need to have remote tuning unless the antenna is right with you. And that means a motorized variable capacitor or some kind of arrangement. And variable capacitors have some interesting loss portions to them that are not a problem in a typical high-impedance circuit. But, for example, there usually is a wiping contact between the frame of the capacitor and the rotating plates. And those can get dirt on them because the plate is mostly exposed and oxidizes, and then you turn it, and that oxidation gets between the two contacts, and you have a problem. Even in old tube equipment that is high impedance, you hear noise in that environment, and it has to be cleaned. But it's particularly important in a small loop to be efficient to have that resistance zero, because if you have a lot of amps, it doesn't take very many ohms to have a big voltage drop and end up with a lot of your power in the resistance. And that's usually the limitation for loops. Interestingly, for a low-frequency receiving loop, it's not so much a problem because on 80 meters and 160 meters, usually the signal-to-noise ratio is limited by not what's happening in the receiver, but what's happening in the atmosphere. So if you have losses, they reduce the noise and the signal together. So you still maintain a good signal-to-noise ratio even if there are losses on receive. But it doesn't work the other way. So you really, the other person that you're talking to has the same atmospheric noise, but your signal is much lower, so he doesn't hear you so well. But you can hear him fine. So it's kind of, can be disconcerting.
Okay, Joel, let me ask the critical question here, okay? Real world performance. If I take one of these small loops, and again, they're only 2-3 feet in diameter, take it out in my yard, and I have a coaxial switch doing an A-B comparison between that and a dipole antenna on the same band. What am I realistically going to see?
I think it very much depends on how those losses are. And it's a matter, and again, you can't just use the receiving side, although you can if you use the S meter, but not if you listen to the signal noise ratio. In fact, I suggest you do that. Because one of the things is we've tested some of these in the lab over the time. We do not have an antenna range. We don't have any way of measuring the actual gain of an antenna or the loss of an antenna. My impression is that if you get rid of all the losses, the performance is comparable to a, let's say, almost comparable to a quarter wave vertical. A loop in the vertical axis is vertically polarized, so it acts like a vertical antenna. So if you were to have a quarter wave vertical fed against ground and had a loop in comparison over the similar ground conditions, I think if the losses are low, it should be almost comparable.
Huh. Now, that's surprising. I wouldn't think. I mean, it's just intuitively you think, well, okay, tiny antenna versus, say, a 40-meter dipole that is 66 feet in length. It just, to me, doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind that horizontal dipole has the benefit of a ground reflection, which reinforces at some elevation angles, and that adds on the order of 6 decibels or an S unit at the appropriate elevation angles. Now, if the antenna is low, it's mostly going straight up, but still that comes down in relatively regional 500-mile kind of communication. Mm-hmm. So if you're comparing at that distance, the horizontal dipole will have an advantage over both the vertical monopole and the small loop.
And the loop, yes.
Now, the typical loop in practice, though, is going to have losses. I mean, there's just no way getting rid of all of them in the design. You can minimize them. Mm-hmm. And how good a job you do at doing that will probably have the biggest impact on how well it compares to other antennas.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly, no matter what, it's going to be smaller than other antennas, and that often makes all the difference.
Yes. Now, with the small size of a loop antenna in mind, is that attractive to an apartment dweller, a condominium dweller? And if so, what are the limitations?
Well, it can be. And in fact, one of the things about small loops is they can still be small loops even though they get bigger. I mean, you're talking about the very small loops.
Yes.
But life gets a little easier in terms of designing them to work well if they're larger. Let's say 20 or 30 feet in circumference. They're still perhaps less than a half wavelength.
Mm-hmm.
But now the impact of the resistive losses is less. The intensity of the magnetic field is less, and people have put them to good use. People have put them around windows, let's say, in their living room, and they're not too visible, and they can work. Now, they do suffer from the same kind of things that all antennas inside buildings suffer from, and that are two things. One is if they're attached to a wall, or there's a wall between them and the person you're talking to, the signal has to go through that wall, and depending on how that wall is made, you may or may not have a lot of loss in getting through that.
True.
But that's the same kind of thing whether you have a loop or a dipole or a whip.
Or any kind of antenna, really.
Any kind of antenna. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, because of these concern about magnetic fields, you do have to be careful in a building because presumably people are fairly close to you. So that means relatively low power. But that's really true of all antennas inside buildings where people are. Unless you can segregate the areas so you have some distance to people. Keep in mind that it's not just the people in your apartment if you're in an apartment building, but perhaps there's some kids playing 6 feet above you that you can't see on the living room upstairs.
Right.
So you have to take that into account as well. And all of that should be carefully considered in your calculations about RF safety, which are particularly important to do with any kind of indoor antenna.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Very good. Well, I mean, the loop has the advantage at least of size. And again, I'm putting myself back in the shoes of the apartment dweller. Size, relatively easy setup if he's not building the loop himself. He's even buying a commercial loop. He can set it up in his living room. He can operate with it, presumably, and then take it down once he's finished, correct?
Yes, that's all true. Now, you talk about commercial loops. We talked about design considerations to reduce losses. Be very careful when you buy a commercial product. They all say they do a wonderful job, but make sure you look at them carefully and make sure that they actually did a good job in designing and building it, because some small potential loss in a loop can make a big difference. So they aren't all the same.
No, it's quality construction does make a big difference in
Absolutely.
That case. Absolutely. All right, Joel, it's question time. We have one here from David, Nancy 8 kilowatt Queen Sierra. And he asks, I put up a new 5-band vertical antenna on the roof of a 4-story building. Lucky David. It is mounted on an 8-foot pipe that is clamped on the framework of a slanted metal roof section. We have the antenna 3 feet from the framework. We are not sure of what our results will be until we finish the cable runs. Is the long pipe on the framework something we should have avoided? Buyer's remorse, potentially, or not.
Well, that's a good question, and it's one of those that it depends a lot on exactly what you're doing. There are two kinds of vertical antennas, multiband vertical antennas. One is the type that has been around for a long time called a quarter wave, electrical quarter wave antenna, and that has to be fed against a ground system. The ground system can be on the ground, can be buried or on the ground radials that can be, they don't have to be a particular length, but the more the merrier so forth, or they can be resonant radials that act like the other half of the antenna on each band. Now, if it's a five-band antenna and you want at least two per band, and four is better, that works out to about 10 to 20 radials. They should be resonant just as if you were building an antenna, so the ends are insulated and so forth. That will work well, and if it's on the roof that doesn't have a lot of people climbing around on it, they probably won't even notice. So you can probably get away with that. If you do that, the antenna is somewhat, or the roof below the radials are somewhat transparent to the antenna, and the fields will be between the monopole and the radials, and it will radiate very nicely. The electrical half-wave antenna, on the other hand, has the other half of the antenna built into it, and it typically has a number of counterpoise rods that are just below the antenna. And that, too, will work in your situation because the fields will be within the antenna, like from the top of the antenna to the bottom of the antenna and some to the counterpoise rods. It will not be affected particularly by the ground underneath it. So that's or the ground of your roof. Now, the other possibility is to try to do, let's say, that quarter wave antenna using the roof, the metal roof, as the ground system. And that is possible, but there are a couple things about it. One is, you need to connect the shield of your coax right below the feed point at the antenna. So the antenna sits on the roof, and the connection has to be between the antenna and the roof just below that point to make it work properly. So that's the center of the ground as far as the antenna is concerned.
Yes.
And that can be tricky because many roofs do not work well as roofs if you drill holes through them.
They don't keep the water out.
They don't keep the water out. The other thing is that the person who designed the roof and built it, long before you got there probably, was not particularly interested in developing a good RF ground or counterpoise system. He was trying to keep the water out. And as a consequence, it probably isn't a single large piece of metal. It is probably strips of metal with seams.
The devil, you say.
Yes, indeed. And unless the person had the foresight, if it were a copper roof or something, to actually solder the seams.
Highly unlikely.
The seams could be filled with tar to keep the water out, but that will not give you a full-size metal ground structure to hook to.
It looks like one, but electrically,
like one.
No.
That's and right. It may be worse than that. It may be intermittent. The electrical connections may come and go depending on stresses on the roof or temperature changes. So things may be changing all the time. It's a little tricky kind of thing. Now, that quarter-wave antenna could work if it were put on the fender of a car. Might not get under bridges, but people use mobile antennas all the time with sort of uncertain metal structures underneath them, being cars.
Yes.
And they work. And if you have a big enough piece of metal there, it will work like a panel of a body panel of a car. But it may not work as well as it would if it were all one large roof. And particularly since you don't know exactly what's there, probably, it may be very difficult to figure it out. So I guess my recommendation is do one of the things that will isolate you from the roof itself. The roof being there won't hurt you as long as you aren't depending on its electrical qualities to be part of the antenna, which you would do if you were trying to feed it against the roof as the ground system. So I think that covers it pretty well. The other thing about it is if you try to do that and you feed the antenna at the top of your 8-foot pole and use the pole as the ground, what happens is the pole actually ends up as part of the antenna. So all of a sudden the antenna is 8 feet longer than the designer thought it would be. It's sort of acting like an off-center fed semi-dipole, if you will, and it probably won't be tuned properly. It'll be not resonant, particularly on the higher frequency bands where that dimension becomes a large fraction of a wavelength. So that's another issue. The question is, the best approach, in my opinion, is to isolate the ground system from the physical structure of the mounting pipes and the roof structure by having a counterpoise or a set of resonant radials that will act as the ground system for the antenna.
Well, this applies, I would think, not only to David's situation here, but coming from Ohio originally, I remember there were a lot of homes out there, farmhouses that had sheet metal roofs or some sort of metal. I know of some hams in addition that will put antennas on carports. In all of those situations, I would think they would have to be rather careful about attempting to rely on that roof as some sort of a ground plane, because what you're saying is electrically it may not be, or at least not something you can count on.
Well, that raises a good point, because if it's your structure and you can get underneath it and see how it's constructed, or you were there when it was built and you know how it's constructed, you at least have something going for you. You at least have some information, and you can take advantage of how it's constructed, and maybe you can feed it at a point where you can tie a couple panels together. Mm-hmm. And if it's your roof, you can probably drill a hole with it and only have family members mad at you if it leaks. as opposed to getting tossed out on the street. So, you know, you have a little more flexibility there. And just as with a mobile antenna, you can actually make this work, but you have to be able to deal with what's there. And that the first part of that is knowing what's there. And if it's your carport, mm-hmm. you can probably tell a lot better than if it's a four-story building that you have no control over.
I would think so. Thank you, Joel. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.